you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, I'm George Chen, and this is SupDoc, a show where we talk documentaries with guests from the worlds of comedy, film, TV, and more. We're very pleased to have the director of 2018's Bathtubs Over Broadway on the show today. It's filmmaker Dava Wisenant. Bathtubs Over Broadway is the story of Letterman comedy writer Steve Young and his journey into the subgenre of theater known as industrial musicals. It starts off as a story about collecting weird records, but turns into something much more emotionally involving. Dava Wisenant is a filmmaker working in Los Angeles and New York. Bathtubs Over Broadway is her feature-length directorial debut and earned her the Albert Maysles Award for Best New Documentary Director at the 2018 Tribeca Film Festival and the 2019 Writers Guild Award for Best Documentary Screenplay. Dava worked in both narrative and nonfiction film for over 20 years with an emphasis on music and comedy. She produced and edited the blues and civil rights film Two Trains Runnin', the 3D rave documentary Under the Electric Sky, and an American Masters film about Merle Haggard. And now here's my talk with Dava. Thank you for coming over to Mi Casa in reference to the film. Mi Hovel, is that right?
Mi Hovel is Sue Hovel.
Mi Hovel is Sue Hovel. In the immortal words of Don Bowles, Dava Wisenant. I know this is how you pronounce your name because I listened to the Alec Baldwin interview that Steve Young did.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming over. Bathtubs Over Broadway. Congratulations on this film.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is your first directorial film?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been an editor for like 20 years, but this is the first thing I directed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been quite the journey, quite the learning experience. Yeah.
And for those who don't know much about it, Steve Young is sort of the subject, but in a way it's about a guy who's obsessed about other people and then you're following him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the subject of corporate musicals is part of the story, but also Steve's journey definitely becomes a huge part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. And one of my first questions I had was, how did you end up? Because it sounded like you guys already knew each other.
Yeah, I used to be an editor at The Late Show, David Letterman, and Steve would bring his comedy pieces down. He was one of the senior writers there. Actually, I think he outlasted everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that his sense of comedy was so bizarre and wonderful, and mm-hmm. I loved working with him, but I didn't know that he collected corporate musical vinyl or anything like that. He told me that way after I worked with him. Yeah.
Yeah. How did that come up? When the book came out? Is that that came up?
He sent me some stuff before that on a CD, and, at first I was like, I don't want to listen to this, man. It's like corporate tunes and Broadway stuff. Like, I'm not into Broadway, but eventually I listened to it and it's like, oh my God, mm-hmm. people have to hear this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. And it's also crazy and funny and weird. And wonderful.
Now, so when you were they still doing this segment when you were working on Dave's show?
No.
Yeah.
Record collection. That segment had been over for a while. And that was actually one of the first things Steve was assigned to when he got to the show. It was still on NBC then.
Mm-hmm.
And he just accidentally, like, one of the head writers just said, hey, take this office. And, oh, yeah, these records in here, the record collection guy did this.
Oh, so he inherited the collection?
Yeah. They put him in charge of it, just kind of, you know, it's just happenstance. Like, oh, take this office. Oh, do you want to do record collection? The guy before did record collection. He's like, sure. He wasn't a record collector before or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did your path end up like that you ended up being an editor at the Letterman show?
Well, I had been cutting all kinds of stuff in Los Angeles, and I moved to New York with a former boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in helping The Late Show transition to HD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that he was like, you guys should hire Dava, you know. So I just started kind of freelancing there. And it was a great job for me because they allowed me to kind of come in and edit for them, and then I could go do an indie film or something and then come back. And so it was a really great job. And I actually was also there for the final days.
They
brought me back to do some of the final montage pieces and stuff for the very end of the show. So that was pretty cool too.
Okay, so you were based in LA normally, but you were just in New York for that time period.
Yeah, I was finishing another film called Two Trains Running around that time. And so I was able to kind of finish that and also work at Late Show for the very end and also film some of that stuff too, because we were the only crew that was ever allowed behind the scenes at Late Show.
Oh, so you did behind. Okay, right. So was some of I was always wondering about the time frame of like when you were working on this, because there's clearly some, like 2015 is when Letterman
ended.
Yeah. So you came back and did a lot of behind the scenes stuff for that.
Yeah. And the so I started filming with Steve way before Dave actually retired. Mm-hmm. But the announcement was pretty soon after we started filming, and I thought, oh my God, this is terrible. That, you know, I was counting on filming Steve, you know, in his job, like as the man behind the man. And
That was like the agenda for the documentary initially, was just to
Follow Steve, this guy who's a comedy writer for Dave Letterman. And, you know, he's got comedy damage. Nothing's funny to him anymore. Or regular stuff isn't funny to him anymore. And, you know, what's it like for him? Like, what makes somebody decide they want to collect corporate musical records, you know? And I was just counting on having a lot more time. Actually, it turned out to be the right amount of time, and we were actually able to film the last days of the show, which is a real turning point for him in his life. So, you know, you never know how things are going to go, but that was kind of awesome.
Right. So he put out the book in 2013. Is that right?
Yeah.
So then that was around the time you guys started talking about starting to film some stuff.
Yeah. And the thing with the book was he'd been collecting these things for like 20 years. He finally put this book out, and then people started coming out of the woodwork like, oh, I used to work on these things, people he'd never heard of. So I followed him as he went to meet new people, and as other avenues kind of that he thought were closed in his searches, they started to open up. So he heard that Pat from The Bathrooms Are Coming was in Chicago, and, you know, and then she said, oh, Sid Siegel's in Chicago too. And he's alive. So I followed him as he went to meet this guy who was composing.
Right. The doorbell and all that stuff. Yeah. That's so, I was wondering about the timing of that, because he clearly did some interviews just for the research for the book, right?
Yeah. He did meet Michael Brown, through his research for the book. And so, but Michael Brown passed away just as we started to film.
Right. So yeah, he's a figure where you don't have, any talking head footage with him or.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We talked to his wife, after the fact, but, so yeah, he had done some research, but he really didn't go to meet anybody, which I found fascinating. It was either on the phone. I mean, Michael Brown lived in New York, so he did go to visit him, but a lot of these other people, he would just call on the phone. He didn't even Skype with them, you know?
Oh, wow.
So it was fun to get out with him, because he had really been in this little bubble of The Late Show. And so it's like a whole world opened up to him as he started to do this and meet these people.
Right. I think, yeah, there's sort of like this personal development story aspect of it.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
It was wild to see, because I knew him as this whole other person, just kind of, you know, funny, weird, cynical comedy writer. And then eventually he started opening up more and more, and it's like, wow, I can't believe this is the same Steve by the end, you know?
Right. I think that is
real life.
Yeah. I think that's the arc that I was sort of identifying, is like sort of maybe also like he's like about 50-ish, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like he, and then he obviously worked at the most kind of cynical comedy show, or like people associate, you know, that generation with a kind of irony, and especially like David Letterman with a certain type of irony. And I see this as a sort of like move through, like there's sort of like an irony bubble that pops is what I like to think of it as. It's just like the market value of the irony is sort of like, how do you emerge out of that?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what you really get to at the end of the film with this guy. It's like, I sort of watched it in two halves, and then I just started watching it over again. I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of see how the setup of this transition in his life goes, where it's like, definitely the same reason that I would imagine people like Jella Biafra or Don Bowles are interested in. It's just like, it's so weird.
Yeah.
It's just so weird. And then you're like, oh, these people had lives and this is like their art.
Absolutely. Yeah. They devoted their careers. A lot of people did. Some of these composers, this was their main thing. And mm-hmm. they put everything they had into it, which is why some of these things are so wonderful.
Yeah. This is not at all like podcasting, by the way. I don't think it has any relationship at all to a lost ephemeral form that no one cares about. But I actually was funny because I was rewatching it. I was remembering little bits that I had forgotten, like, oh, you go to, is it Co-op 87 in New York? Because Ben Stidell is the guy behind the counter who I actually know.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
There's a lot of people I kind of know in this film.
Wow.
Like Ben I knew. He, I think, just opened a new record store called Brooklyn Record Exchange. And he's just like this befuddled, like, you know, kind of like electronic music hipster guy. And he's just like, the person that Steve reminds me a lot of is Andy Daly. Do you know the actor Andy Daly? I will show you a picture at the end of this.
Okay.
He's very, like, if we were to cast, we do a game on the show where we, like, try to cast a biopic version of a documentary. I'm like, that's my casting for Steve Young. It's Andy Daly.
Oh,
yeah. Which I don't know if you've thought about any of the people you would cast. Jello is Jello. Don Bowles is Don Bowles. I don't think he replaced those two people. Yeah.
Wow. Who would be Steve? I can't wait to see who you're.
Well, that's the only one I got was really Andy. But I'll show you the picture. And he's like a Upright Citizens Brigade kind of person. But yeah. And then Pyramid Records in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Also, I recognized that environment. That's a shop my friend used to own.
Yeah. We were any place that we would go with Steve, he would go in and try to just see if anybody had heard of it. And nobody. When I was with him, nobody had ever heard of these things.
Yeah. Did you go with him to Amoeba ever? Did he go to Amoeba Hollywood? Because I feel
he
like you can find those.
He did not go to Amoeba Hollywood. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah. If
you
he's still
run.
On the hunt, which I imagine he would be.
He's still doing it. In fact, since we've been on the festival circuit, you know, every city we would go to the record store in every city. And in Detroit, he found some. And that was very exciting. And it happened to be on record store day.
Okay.
And then... and then where else were we? Oh, he did something in Florida and it was like Orlando or something. He found this amazing record store and got like more than 10, which is, that never happens for
yeah.
him anymore.
Detroit makes sense because the auto industry seems to be like, the auto industry has a lot of marketing money to just throw away. Actually, the other connection I had to this, speaking of being in Los Angeles, is Jonathan Ward is like a friend of a friend of mine.
Get out of here.
And that's like kind of the initial person who he was like, oh, you should maybe have this guy on your show. And he was like, yeah, I mean, I'm in it, but I'm not like the main part of it. And at this point, I hadn't seen the film. So he's like, it's like, you really should talk to Deva. So that's how he directed me towards you, which makes sense. But he is in it significantly, it seems
He's
like.
He's such a wonderful part of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he really was one of Steve's main collecting buddies for all those years, you know. So that's one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Oh, yeah, when they're just sitting there nerding out about the...
Yeah. And one of the things was, you know, we had to figure out how to play these songs without totally stopping down the whole narrative of the film. And... that was one day where my co-writer and I were playing with that footage, and he was like, well, why don't you just try putting that song underneath, you know, to see if it lines up. And I was like, there's no way it's going to line up. And so we put the song they were singing in, and they were doing the parts exactly that, you know, the timing was exact. And it was like, oh my God. So that's one of the most wonderful kind of almost accidents that we...
Oh, but aren't they listening to the record in the room?
No.
Oh, they're not. They were just, oh, you guys put that under it.
Yeah.
Oh, I was convinced that he actually was like, it was like diegetic sound in the room or something.
He started singing it and then Steve started singing it with him. And then we kind of faded it up.
Yeah. You know? No pitch shifting, no time shifting or anything. Yeah.
It was just like, they know these songs backwards and forwards.
Oh my gosh.
And that really, to me, showed how much they know these things, because they can sing them like, you know, you kind of mention one line and then both of them are off singing. And it was so cool to see that he had a friend like that.
Yeah.
That he could share these things.
The Batman and Robin vibe.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
My young ward. Literally.
And they're both so funny. I mean, John Ward is just so funny, but just really deadpan, though.
Yeah. So my friend knows him from, he collects 78s as well.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. And I believe he works at the Getty.
Yes.
Is that right? So he's, yeah. It is sort of like a librarian kind of problem in a way. It's like kind of like if you're in the world of like metadata, this is sort of like essentially the problems they're having with tracking this stuff down. Like they're like talking about the early days of eBay when people, yeah. just it's just records. There's no like subgenres or anything. And it's such a random needle in a haystack process to find these things in like the late 90s.
Looking past it, you know.
Oh yeah.
Most people, it was getting thrown away. I mean, how many crazy recordings were just thrown away because nobody knew this was a thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Which is, I think, the other thing that I see around as I do collect records as well. So there was that sort of like look of familiarity when I was watching this film.
What do you collect?
I've got a lot of like you know. It came up in the 90s and sort of like the indie rock punk world. So, and then I took a kind of a left turn into like noise music in the 2000s. So I've got a lot of like experimental noise records.
Oh, wow.
And cassettes and stuff all behind you over there. But which is also why when I see something like, you know, Don Bowles's collection.
And, insane.
Yeah. And also just like, he's like, oh, these are all my lost pet flyers. I'm like, yeah, there is something about, okay, I'm not going to call him a hoarder, but I think there was like this fine line between being an obsessive collector and like hoarding and sort of maybe it's just like how easily it is for you to find the stuff in your piles.
And I mean, Don has some amazing records. He spins around LA. He spins this stuff out.
Right. He has a weekly event, the Ding-a-ling.
The Monty Bar on Saturdays. Yeah. And then, the
Club
on
Ding-a-ling,
Wednesdays at the Hyperion.
And obviously, Don Bowles was the drummer of the Germs in a bunch of other bands. Still, like, I see him just playing drums with random people around town all the time.
Yeah. He's a fixture. And the cool thing about seeing him and Steve together was, you know, I had never met Don before I got involved with this project. And we had just this one crazy day with him. And Steve and Don together, it's like they could be a comedy team. I mean, they're both so witty and so fast. And just the jokes flying back and forth. I thought these guys could be their own show because very, very funny. And Steve is more the like kind of reserved guy. And then Don is just saying these crazy things. But it's like tennis back. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So funny
level of banter. We like professional head comedy writer for Letterman,
and
then a punk drummer. Yeah,
can hold his own against the veteran comedy.
Yeah,
for sure.
Did you grow up with like a comedy background at all, how did you end up like?
I mean, I think I was attuned to it. My father had the driest sense of humor, but we were always laughing at weird stuff in my family. So I was primed for it, but then working at Late Show, really, that was great experience timing and seeing, you know, you get instant feedback on whether the thing that you did that day is good. And if, you know, could it have been better and what made people laugh and when.
And editing like for Letterman, is it like sort of like field pieces or like
a lot of field pieces. Uh-huh. And yeah. And those little things they called extras, like in the monologue, they would do funny little weird graphics things. And yeah, it was kind of all over the place. But
what era was it that you were working there?
2003 to 2008, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
The writer's strike was right in the tail end of that, right? 07?
I finished before that, I think.
Okay. So you were in New York for a while then.
Indie films around that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it was off and on for a while. It was like a little family, you mm-hmm. know. So many people had been there for years. Like Steve was there for 25 years.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was listening to it, like he got that job like right after college or something.
Yeah, he was at the Harvard Lampoon. Mm-hmm.
Many TV writers are Ivy League, as we are always reminded.
But he's so down to earth. I mean, you know, he didn't even know... he thought Harvard was in New York. Like he's like, they should never have let me into Harvard, but he was from Massachusetts. I think that helped him.
Yeah. So you went to film school or what was your background?
I went to the University of Miami and yeah, it was, we had a film program. It was like film and television. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was pretty good, but we were cutting on film actually. And we had like 3/4-inch tape to tape. There was no Avid when I was there.
Yeah. We talked to a few filmmakers from Florida. Ronnie Asher has been on the show.
Cool.
And he's from Florida. And I met this guy, Sid Guerin.
Yeah.
Who is does credits, visual stuff also.
They did our animation.
The intro animation. Yeah. Right. I think I saw his name in the credits. I'm like, oh, I just met this guy.
Yeah.
At Zebulon with... because Bill Orcutt was in town. And
they're so talented. Mind-blowing films. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I really love, like, there's kind of like these two... like the intro graphics and the song and then sort of your closing bit, which is like goes to another level of like, which I don't know how much, I don't know that there's spoilers to really spoil in the film, but I'd say watch the film for sure. We could talk a little bit about the end of that because I also, my other random connection is I used to work for Jell-O.
What?
In San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah. And like, so that was another thing. People were like, oh, you should watch this film, Jell-O. And I'm like, he's in every documentary. I'm like, he's literally in any music documentary. And like, I'm just like, when I saw like, I had not seen that angle into, I've been in that house.
Oh.
But I've not seen like that angle from that high up angle you have down into like the living room. And it's like, it looks like a ski chalet with like those weird stones jutting out. I'm like, I saw that back. I'm like, oh yeah. And then it's crazy because like, I worked for him for like 5 years. So like when I watch a film, like I watched that Ronnie Bingenheimer film when I was still working for Jell-O and I had fallen asleep. That's not to say it's a great film. I just, I happened to fall asleep and then I just heard Jell-O's voice.
Oh yeah.
And then I'm just like, you don't want to hear your boss at like 1 a.m. after you've passed out, like on TV. It's like, oh, this is terrifying. But yeah, no. So you, I guess that was your trip to San Francisco when you guys went to Pyramid was just to shoot that footage with Jell-O.
Yeah, to meet up with Jell-O. Yeah, that was one of the most intense things, you know.
Well, I know that he goes to bed at like 6 a.m. So he probably was like, "You can come over after 7 p.m." Was it something like that?
It was definitely late, but it was early for him, but late for, you know, late in the day. That was for sure.
Yeah.
And he was making
early
breakfast
for him.
He was like, don't film me making breakfast. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
But, he has a lot of amazing records.
Oh God.
Too.
Yeah.
The two of them nerding out was pretty fun.
Yeah. That's so random that they know each other. Even. It's such a small world.
And they really appreciate each other too. You know, that's what's so beautiful about this record collecting part of this is that there's this, it's about sharing and it's also competitive. So it's this funny thing back and forth. But you know, and these guys are so unlike each other. Mm-hmm. I said that, I think. And Jell-O was like, how do you know we're unlike each other? Like, maybe we're going to be sleeping together later. You don't know.
Oh man. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of, there was something about this also reminded me a little bit of Crumb.
Oh yeah.
You'd be like, just sort of like the arcane, like it's like, this ends up being like sort of nostalgic in a way or like sentimental in a certain way, which like, I think with Crumb, he's like a guy who collects like 78s and it's sort of just like, I don't get modern music, you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I think the thing about it with these guys, what ends up happening with, I don't know if I'm phrasing this properly. The fact that like Steve becomes sort of like the caretaker of like these people's whole creative lives and stuff that they've forgotten about to some extent, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said that he would call the people to say, you know, he wanted to talk about whatever, Diesel Dazzle. And first they would be suspicious, like, okay, is this a joke? And you're from Letterman, so you're going to make fun of us.
You know? They already knew about the record collection part of Letterman, probably.
Yeah, or at least just that he's a pretty cynical dude. Mm-hmm. And then they would talk and they'd realize that he's serious about this. And then they would go back and start listening to their stuff again and call him and say, oh my God, I started listening to that again. It was really good, wasn't mm-hmm, it? And mm-hmm. just, they had written it off as something that nobody would ever care about. Mm-hmm. So that's what I love. I also love that Don and Jello too. They're not really sitting in judgment. They're kind of open to mm-hmm. a lot of different kinds of music and even Broadway musicals on a certain level, you mm-hmm. know, if it has something that's interesting to them. I like that. The openness.
Yeah, and I see what would attract, like, knowing Jello, like, what would attract him to this concept of, like, it's a corporate record, you know? Yeah, exactly.
The things we're not supposed to hear about the way companies work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They like, want to motivate people to sell, you know.
And I think tractors. He makes a point, which I was thinking when watching this, of just, like, this type of work doesn't exist anymore, right? Like, the idea that you are, like, a company man or something, that your right. entire career is in one field, and, like, I have the same accounts for 40 years, and, like,
yeah.
you know, we get a steak dinner and a gold watch at the end. You know, that whole world is gone.
And that you would stay with the company for that long, and so the company had to invest in you. Mm-hmm. You know, it was worth it to them to have a big annual convention yeah. and party because they needed you to be pumped to stay there and have, you know... It did seem like it was a totally different time.
Yeah, it doesn't work with our, like, gig economy world. There's no, like, here's a YouTube video. Here's just a DIY video of, like, oh, this is how you should have water and gum in your car when you're picking people up.
Yeah. Uber musical.
Don't ask for any of the corporate profits that the right. overlords are getting. Yeah.
Yeah. Way different world.
Yeah, like, and just, like, so that part of it I do think is really interesting of just, like, the psychology of, like, also, like, who decided to make a sexy Purina commercial?
Exactly.
Like, such a weird
musical. Yeah, for the salesman.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, talking about cash registers and that, you know, that one was, that particular musical was all to get the guys to understand the promotions, mm-hmm. to get the salesman to understand the promotions that were going to be in, like, the grocery store or whatever. It was like they had to explain it. It had to be, you needed a sexy lady in there.
Right, because it's so dry, like the instructional aspects of it.
Yeah, you get 8 cent coupon or something.
But then that's an interesting thing because like a lot of the performers are women, but then I'm like, are these sales forces mostly men? Is that kind of the vibe that I feel like it's 2019. Everything has like a gender component to it when you think about it, but yeah.
I asked every single woman mm-hmm. that I interviewed about what it was like for them. So as far as the corporate musicals started kind of mid-50s, mm-hmm. And the sales forces were definitely mostly men. It seemed like we were seeing more in the 70s. It was starting to change just as far as the pictures that we could find of the different musicals and who was involved. There was also like Tupperware did stuff, and that was mostly women, of course, mm-hmm. In those sales forces. But it was definitely mostly men. And the women said that, like Pat and Sandy from The Bathrooms Are Coming, they said, well, you know, yeah, it was kind of sexist, but that was just the way that it was. Mm-hmm. And we were beautiful and we enjoyed the like, you know, it's not really the answer that you want as a feminist. To hear, but I did ask them about
Well, that, then like so. She met her husband as one of the stars of the show. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm thinking more like, we don't know we don't know what the people in the audiences, how they felt about stuff. That's the one thing that I started wondering. I'm like, what is going on with these people at these conventions?
We found anecdotal evidence of, sometimes they would have to fill out comment cards about, did you like this show? Mm-hmm. And how did you feel it was this year? So we had some written evidence mm-hmm. of that. And then we managed to find a couple of, people like there was the guy that runs a Ford dealership in LA, and he was talking about how they went, and it was something they looked forward to, but it was nothing really like earth shattering, which is why I didn't include it in the film. It was just kind of like, I mean, we have Florence Henderson saying that the salesmen would lose their frickin' minds at these things, especially when they would finally reveal the car. You know, and the structure of the show is generally like they would tease this stuff all the way through. And then at the end, there's like the big finale number where they show you the cars and people would freak out.
Come on and spread the word to every sales creator. Get the news in each new refrigerator. See the freezers, that are pleasers there.
I am 97% sure that is Michael Brown.
Really?
Absolutely.
What is that? Does it sound like another track that he wrote?
It sounds like seven of his songs were put in a blender.
Oh, wow. The reason I think I suggested Walter Marx is because it's a Kurbawi MPO production.
But Michael Brown did the 64 Dodge show.
Which is Kurbawi MPO.
Yes, it is.
Oh, yes.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The documentation at the time is either like home video footage or like these vinyl records.
It
seems like they skipped even the tape, the cassette tape era.
Well, so a lot of what I found was people who were in the shows, they would give me VHS tapes of the stuff, you know, like the Burger King thing we have on VHS. But mostly they weren't filmed at all. I mean, it was amazing. They would even do a vinyl record of the show because it was so disposable to them. It was, you know, once that show was done, it was like, we're going to worry about next year's products. Mm-hmm. So this year's products, we don't care about, you know.
Right.
Once we already know how, you know, we told them how to sell it and we had the party, you know, just forget about it. That's why it was so hard to find any film. And we were so lucky to that some people had actually kept stuff that they worked on in their basement, you know, like the Bathrooms Are Coming film, which is.
Did you talk to any people that were like corporate archivists at the corporations?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah. I was wondering about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The Coke archivists, you know, they gave us some films, but it was just kind of like the Teach the World to Sing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really stuff that they were doing for their conventions earlier, like 50s, 60s, that stuff that we have on vinyl is amazing from that time. And JCPenney, we talked to them, and Ford. And Ford didn't have anything. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I think we had one weird GM clip. It was like they had filmed this thing. It was like a circus. It was, but there was no audience. It was like they had just filmed the show after the fact, and there was like an elephant. It was very weird. There was so much weird stuff, man.
And you've got it all, right? You've got it on a hard drive somewhere.
Yeah, I mean,
converted like from like old formats and stuff. Like,
yeah, so much
U-matics or
exactly.
something.
Yeah, there. I had some 3/4-inch tape stuff, beta. You know, it's like all everywhere.
Yeah. I'm surprised I didn't see any 8-track collecting or anything like that. That was probably could have been part of it. Yeah, so it's like an ephemeral sort of, I think a way to think about it is like it's sort of like the subconscious of capitalism kind of, right?
Yeah. Oh, ooh.
Ooh.
I love that. Wow.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first. Yeah, yeah, like sort
if
of
you hear it again, you know where I got it.
Exactly. But I think that's like a really fascinating part of this, like sort of the forgotten even by the fact that it was like, okay, what was the budget? Like $3 million?
That was
for a show in like mid 1970s.
It was before that.
Before
like
that, even
My Fair Lady. They spent $450,000 to put up My Fair Lady, and the same year the Chevy musical was $3 million.
So it's like six times as much money.
Yeah,
I mean, as like My Fair Lady with like Julie Andrews.
And there was no way they were going to make the money back at Chevy. It was more just a tax deduction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. So as someone who is like attempting to like kind of do acting in LA and also like starting in San Francisco, there is like the fact that like in San Francisco it was like, okay, almost all non-union work, and a lot of industrials were like for the tech industry.
Yeah.
So there's like a lot of random work.
Yeah.
And so it was something relatable about that in that way. I mean, like, I'm never going out for anything where you have to sing and dance, but I go out for a lot of like, you're an engineer. I'm like, okay. Yeah, I buy it. You know, I'd buy that.
So no singing and dancing?
No singing and dancing for me. But like the industrial world, it's sort of like doing stuff. There's stuff where it's just like, you are going to be in a corporate training video. Or I've had friends be like, you're on a test I'm taking. Like there's a video test.
Wow.
And like you're one of the multiple choice options, like reading this line about like, you know, environmental damage, and they just screen cap it. I'm like, is this you when you had hair? I don't remember. So it's like funny also seeing it from that side of being like, yeah, it's money. Like you're a performer. Yeah. Like even there's a time when Martin Short and Andrea Martin just needed the buck, you know?
Right. And and they got to practice, you know, their craft.
And Tony Randall.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Newhart, it was crazy.
Alec Baldwin even said he does these once in a while, but they're more like Q&As these days or something. It's more like meet and greets now.
Yeah. These days they just hire somebody to do their own act. It's not special material for the company. Generally.
Yeah. There's like corporates. I know for comedians, there's like corporates where it's just like, they're like, okay, what am I supposed to, what am I not supposed to say? And then that's it. Oh, yeah, I know Facebook and Google and stuff. They've got like, you know, especially like Facebook, they've got like artist residencies and things like that now.
What?
Like friends of mine do like, yeah, they've done like artist residencies at Facebook.
Wow.
Where it's just like, make a mural. You know, I think Facebook learned early on that the murals is, well, you know, the story about David Cho?
No.
The sort of like street graffiti adjacent artist, visual artist. He did a mural for Facebook early on, and he's like, you don't need to pay me, just give me stock. And then so they went public, and he's like, oh yeah, I'm super rich now.
Oh my god. So then they own the mural,
but he got the stock in exchange. So and then it raised his profile in general.
Amazing.
Yeah. So there's these sort of different types of patronage that exist now. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. But this was like the level of patronage actually for, you know, being a creative at this time, I think, is like, you know, very different than, as we're saying, compared to now. And also, it was interesting when you showed like some of the clips of like things that do still happen, like, well, Walmart will do a show or something, or it's like a little sketch in the middle of like a presentation or something.
Yeah, it's not the full book musical with the story about the salesman who's down on his luck until he encounters the new Ford tractor of the, you know, to sell or whatever. Yeah. Like that kind of.
And there's sort of like a crossover. Some of these were parodies, right? Of like
a few, yeah.
A few were like parody songs.
I think Steve was more focused on all the original songs and original musicals, but they would very often take familiar songs that people knew and base the show around that because they felt like that was something that was already memorable. So it would help them remember the sales tips or whatever that were in the song.
Yeah.
Those are pretty great. Too.
Yeah. I imagine that would be a lot of now. It would just be like, it's going to be Old Town Road, but it'll be about literally repairing roads or something. Yeah.
Yeah. The Raguletto, you know, that one was obviously based on this, you know, songs that existed, but about pasta sauce.
Yeah. Steve was a Dr. Demento fan, it sounds like. He was, I think he referenced that in that Alec Baldwin interview, I think.
Oh, did he?
I think he did,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but I'm not a Dr. Demento person, so you kind of like you kind of went into this world fairly with like
cold. Oh yeah.
Just like, I know this guy. He's really into this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to see what it's going to be. I'm going to follow him and his passions, which I think is like my favorite kind of like documentary that's like weird Americana.
Yeah.
It's like, it definitely is in that vein of like an American movie or something like that.
Yes,
it's
just absolutely.
Like sort of
Anvil.
Whimsical, but like, you know, very American psychology to it.
Yeah. And then it's been kind of cool to show it around in other countries too, because we'd kind of been told like, oh, only Americans are going to be interested in this. And that's absolutely not true, because mm-hmm. it is about such a strange part of America and our history that I think it's fascinating to other countries. Mm-hmm. That's been pretty wild. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of the film festival highlights you've had from film? Also, you won an award.
A couple.
At Tribeca, yes?
Yeah, so okay. I got a directing award at Tribeca, and that mm-hmm. was awesome.
From De Niro himself, like, claimed that was one of his top films?
He did. Apparently, he wouldn't stop talking about it. The publicist for Tribeca said to me, you know, we're trying to get him to talk about other movies.
To the point where now De Niro is willing to do corporates. He's like, yeah. like, I'll do the Walmart. I'll do it.
It's take good. That yeah. step. It'll
keep it real.
Yeah. And then also Writers Guild Award.
Okay.
Best documentary screenplay.
Oh, awesome.
So that was cool. Yeah. I feel like, you know, documentary storytelling, it doesn't always have to be this kind of educational experience where you know, you've learned like in the 50s, they did this kind of industrial musical. If there's another way to tell a story, that's always what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more of a narrative arc. Kind of thing.
And you worked on reality too, or
I did a little bit of that. Yeah. You know, that kind of teaches you how to do a lot with a little. Mm-hmm. As an editor, I learned a lot about that. But it was ultimately soul killing and I had to get out.
I can imagine. Yeah. I've talked to a few people that like started, or they got all their training chops basically in reality, which I guess is sort of like a genre that only kind of blew up in the 2000s, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was great for learning how to work fast and, you mm-hmm. know, but ultimately just the amount of cheating is just a little too intense.
Mm.
Not on every show. I mean, I did this genealogy show for NBC that I actually enjoyed quite a bit, and it seemed like the overall message was pretty positive.
Pre-23andMe, the genealogy show.
Yeah.
Right. So they were like getting, I remember the show. Yeah.
Who do you think you are?
Yeah. Who are some of the people you did segments with?
It was, well, we had Spike Lee and Gwyneth Paltrow, Sarah Jessica Parker. Mm-hmm. So many. God, mm-hmm. Lionel Richie. That was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I mean, full gamut of all kinds of stories, which I loved, you know, and that it was based on a British show that was much more doc style, much less like, you know, network TV. And I loved the British version. Mm-hmm. I think probably here it was perceived as very sleepy, but I loved it. It was so my vibe.
Yeah. The sort of for network television, I can imagine you had to like pump up the drama to a degree.
Oh my God.
Where like in the UK, things can like, I mean, like The Detectorists can be a show, you know, like things can take their time.
Yeah. And this was like, you know, at the end they were like, you need to put in a pop song in the last, you know, last act of the thing. It was like, what? How does this fit? You know,
yeah.
Trying to make the pop song work. It just, oh God. But
they just hand you down like some musical assignments. Yeah.
So I really appreciated the sleepy British version.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately just went on to, from there, I actually just felt like I need to be more in the actual documentary community that fits me so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to get in depth with these different areas that I wouldn't know about. Like I wasn't a Broadway fan before this, and having to do all the research for this film made me appreciate Broadway in mm-hmm. a way I never had. And I did a blues and civil rights movie before.
Oh, okay. What's that one?
That's Two Trains Running.
Okay. It's a documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sam Pollard directed it, and mm-hmm. I edited and co-produced. And that one, you know, I didn't know enough about the blues before that. And it's a great way to dig in, you mm-hmm. know. I love that about documentary.
So you also edit your own film that you directed in this case. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a co-writer because mm-hmm. I feel like you do need somebody to bounce ideas off and to challenge you to be, you know, is this the most efficient way to tell the story and what can we lose and what do we need more of? So, but I did edit it myself. I didn't really want to. It was more that, you know, our budget was only so high and I could afford to pay myself that rate. Nobody else.
And then how did Letterman get brought in as a producer, right? He has a producing credit.
Executive producer. He very early on, we showed him some pitch material, and he agreed to give us some early support. So that was pretty cool.
Right, because he has a production company as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was just personal.
It wasn't through.
Just because he believed in Steve and really appreciated his loyalty to the show. So many people left over the years, and Steve just stayed and stayed and didn't want to go to another show.
That's the thing that I kind of noticed at the end. It's like almost like he was expecting the show to keep going, you know.
Or he knew. I think everybody knew it was going to end at some point.
Yeah.
But he hadn't really. He's not
near retirement age at all.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just wasn't jumping into trying to get another late night gig either. Just he's been writing songs. He's such a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. And that is something that has developed out of this project that I didn't expect.
You could update us on how things have been going for Steve since this film came out in the last year.
He still stays in touch with all these people that we went out and met. They've become like family to him. So mm-hmm. he, you know, calls them like he would call his parents to check in on them. We found a copy of Gould Growing.
Oh, the hardest to find.
That only Don
had it.
Yeah. So somebody who'd seen the film reached out and said, "Hey, I have a copy of this. I've had it for 20 years. My dad used to work at Gould," and he gave it to Steve, which is a beautiful kind of fun thing that's happened out of this. And he's been writing here and there on certain shows, but mostly he's just trying to find his own way now, I think. Mm-hmm. And maybe not in the late night comedy world.
Yeah, which is like such a different world than 1990s or even like the era of the great late night wars.
Yeah.
It's like so different now, I imagine. Yeah. From talking to people that, you know, knowing some people that work on shows and like just listening to interviews and stuff. Yeah. It seems like so competitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he just, you know, he had enough 25 mm-hmm. years of the same gig. It was very much like the guys, the salesman who would work at a company 25 years. There was Steve almost in the same situation.
Yeah. I noticed that parallel of like where you really relate like the end of like the Letterman show is like this institution also.
Yeah.
It's sort of like ending of institutions.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was being able to kind of tell those parallel stories was something I didn't expect that we would be able to do, but I was really happy when it worked out that mm-hmm. I could tell them that way and that maybe people would feel that he was
a company man.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then we should mention a little bit about the end scene.
Okay, the musical number.
Yeah, like how did you guys arrive at this concept to that's the ultimate way to end this?
Thank you. Yeah, it wasn't something that I had envisioned from the beginning. It was more after he started to meet these people and connect to them so much, and I realized how much Hank Beebe, who had written Diesel Dazzle, was a hero to him. And so it's like, okay, why don't we do a Muppet movie kind of ending where we can get everybody together that he's met along the way? Maybe it is giving it away, but you still can't see how we did it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
And he got to write the song with Hank Beebe, and that was really cool. It was like learning from a legend in a way that this man has learned so much about songwriting and about how to emote and how to share your soul, you know, mm-hmm. in a song. And so it's, working that out with them was really cool.
And I was just like, did you get Jello to actually leave his house?
He was very invested.
Yeah. Where did you shoot all that stuff? Is there an East Coast and a West Coast one?
No, it was all West Coast? Warner Brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. The lot. And we could only afford one day, really hoping it didn't rain or anything.
Just maximize your La La Land dreams.
Yeah. And it was cool. I mean, we had everybody came in and did the kind of cast recording session one day, and then we did costumes the next day, and then we shot it on the third day, and it was intense, man. It was one of the best and most challenging days of my life. It was so hard, but so wonderful.
Because it's so different from like when you think of documentary filmmaking. You don't think you just like, oh, let's actually make a musical, basically.
Yeah. And with, you know, makeup trucks and all kinds of, you know, grip and electric. I'm just
props,
like, oh my God, how is this even happening? But it was, it was really great. And the vibe was so good with everybody. And even Dawn and Jello, like just... So like they were so pumped to meet the ladies from the bathrooms are coming.
Oh, I was going to say like they probably only knew each other and Steve.
Yeah.
But also like I'm like, did they bring real copies of those records out to like sit in the sun?
Oh, no.
I'm like, those are like reproductions. No,
we made photocopies.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
To, like,
like, there's no way those guys are bringing those in the sunlight. I'm like, how that's probably the most sunlight Jello's gotten in a long time. is I was thinking.
He was so great though.
He showed up early on set, or he showed up on his call time is like,
remember.
My call time better be afternoon.
I don't remember exactly that. I feel like there were no problems though. He was just really into it, and you know, I should have the plungers in this hand as opposed to this hand, and you know,
he always brings up like he's like, you know, I did major in theater. That was his like college major before at Santa Cruz.
He never said that to
me. He didn't? Because one time he came down and did ASCAT, actually, because Matt Besser is a huge like Dead Kennedys fan. Okay. And he's like, well, I'll tell them I have a theater background.
I love your like, Jello impression.
I do kind of like a lot of people do kind of the heightened, like, you know, I do the like, well, send me a fax. Like I do that version of Jello. So,
I really love that guy. Yeah. I mean, I've so appreciated how cool he was about.
He
that
is like a true, like he likes, he just loves records.
Yeah.
He's like, I could spend money on drugs or records. And I decided that the records would last longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole musical number though was just so magical and perfect. I don't know, just something about, I thought the, I don't know if documentary people are going to so support what I'm doing here. Maybe they will, but you know.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if they support this show, so it's fine.
But it just felt like the right thing to do for the movie. And it's kind of, you know, he starts in this really cynical place at the beginning of his journey. And you know, over these years, he's opened up so much and changed so much. It's the full 180 to where he starts. And just how could we not do that, you know? And he gets to do it with his hero. So just very heartwarming kind of stuff.
And did Hank write the song in the beginning too? Or Steve wrote the song in the beginning?
That was our composer, Anthony DiLorenzo.
Okay, and who did like the score sounds?
Yeah,
okay.
We had an original score and we recorded with an orchestra in Seattle. And that was important to me because I felt like, you know, in the heyday of these things, they had full orchestras and they were employing musicians. And, you know, it wasn't just the performers and choreographers and stuff. It was also
orchestras that
were getting paid out of this stuff and making a living and able to continue their art in whatever way through getting paid for these things. So I thought we've got to have an orchestra. We've got to have an original score with thematic material and really super melodic kind of throwback vibe. And Tony DiLorenzo, that's his whole thing. I mean, he's so great. He's like the secret weapon, I think. If people know about him, I mean, he can do like John Williams kind of vibe. He can do anything like that. Super melodic, gorgeous stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, very creative.
And as that was another question I had is like, was there any issues using the songs? Because I know when I talk to people about filmmaking, like music rights always ends up being like a big blocker for people.
That was, I investigated all that before I ever started. Mm-hmm. Like, are we going to be able to use this stuff?
Like, is Coca-Cola going to be like, no, yeah, I own that.
Right. Am I going to get sued by McDonald's or whatever? And so a lot of it is fair use, especially everything after like 79.
Right.
So all that stuff. That's why I could only use certain amount, you know, smaller clips from some of these shows because it was fair use and it was just enough to prove the point. But yeah, sometimes we did have to reach out to the companies and they were surprised that this stuff was even done. You know, the people working there now had no idea this was ever done. And so they were pretty cool. Like JCPenney was cool about it. Ford was cool about it. But generally we didn't even, you know, it was fair use. We didn't mess around with that too much.
Yeah. Nice. So after all of this, all this stuff you've been doing and promoting this film, what's on your docket now? What are you working on these days?
I'm doing another music doc right now.
Okay.
And developing some stuff, actually some scripted things as well, because I just feel like there's so many different ways to tell a true story. You know, you just got to figure out the right one. So we're some comedy projects.
Oh, cool.
As well. Yeah.
And you obviously know all these comedy people as well.
Yeah. One thing we're doing with Steve right now, it's, I'm pretty excited about a half hour comedy thing. So yeah. So a lot of stuff kind of in the bubbling up stages. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see what actually happens. And nice. If I can keep making a living at all doing this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Have you had to take in any editing work for money? Or
I did one consulting job for a Hulu documentary.
Okay.
And then, I've mostly been turning things down, trying to get this other stuff going. So we'll see if that was a good move or not.
Well, it's like, as long as you like the technology doesn't change. It's like, it's always, yeah. You can all, well, you want to get to a point where you have someone else editing and you're just overlooking their work.
That would be, I mean, I know I'll always be editing on some level, but mm-hmm. It would be nice to have some people that I can trust, you know, that have the same story sense that I do. And so that's what I'm really looking for right now is other creative partners like that mm-hmm. that get my vibe.
Did you have any like kind of mentors in editing or?
No, and I really feel like it's so important. I mean, I did Susan Littenberg. She's actually a producer on the movie. She was probably, I would say, the one mentor I had in my career. And she has been an editor for a long time. And we both worked. We met on a Soderbergh movie called Solaris.
Oh, yeah, Solaris, yes.
I was an edit PA, and she's given good guidance over the years. Mm-hmm. But that I feel like that's so important, and I didn't know that early on. Mm-hmm. Did you have a mentor?
No. I mean, I wonder, I've thought about this a lot in terms of, like, whatever I was attempting to do, and, like, you know, I wouldn't say that my relationship with Jello was, like, a mentor-mentee relationship, because I was never trying to do the same thing that he was doing.
Yeah.
But in the sense of like, I wanted to, you know, I had a record label. I worked for his record label. I kind of wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. But I kind of was always looking for something like that. And even now, it's interesting because I do stand up, and it's like anyone who's been doing it longer than me in a way is a mentor, even if they're, you know, depending on where our careers are at, even if we're, you know, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's just like they have, everyone is someone you can learn from, I guess is how it feels to me at this point. Yeah. Like, I learn from people who are just starting out. I'm like, oh, they kind of remind me what it's like to, you know, just be starting out as well. So, yeah.
I love the work of Doug Prey, and I've gotten to know him lately.
I know the name, but he's a...
Director okay. and editor. Mm-hmm. Most recently, he did the Defiant Ones for HBO.
Oh, yeah. The Defiant Ones,
But, he started way back.
In terms of, like, documentary stuff.
Yeah, and the fact that he's directing and editing. And then also Kate Amend is another person I've gotten to know, and she's a phenomenal editor. And so, you know, just trying to stay connected to those people who are good people mm-hmm. at heart, you know, mm-hmm. and who are so talented as well, and just how they manage to stay in this and not get discouraged sometimes.
Did you learn anything working with Soderbergh, or like how closely?
Well, I was mostly just a PA on those mm-hmm. kinds of projects and assistant editor. But he did meet with us actually after Bathtubs came out and had seen the film and was very encouraging. Spent 2 hours with us talking about it and really loved it, which was to be sitting in the room with the guy and he's telling, like, he's an idol, you know, mm-hmm. and he's telling me that he liked our movie. And it's just, that was my kind of head exploding, I can't believe this is happening kind of thing. So mm-hmm. that was really encouraging.
De Niro and Soderbergh, just a couple of fans of our guest, David Wizenant, you know, friends in high places. And also, I guess, Letterman you communicate with regularly, or like regards to the film and stuff.
Well, he's been, his kind of team has been helping us support the film and tweet about it and all that kind of stuff.
But, is there exclusivity with Netflix, or do you have like other is it available other streaming services?
It's on iTunes and Amazon. Focus picked it up, and then they have, you know, Universal Home Entertainment is kind of responsible for getting it out into the world. So it, as far as I know, isn't available internationally at all, which is crazy.
Oh, it's not on Netflix overseas or anything right now? Oh, no. So crazy. You can buy it on iTunes, though, or no, or not yet?
You can.
Internationally?
I don't know if you can buy it.
Okay. Because we have some UK and Australia and Canada listeners,
I think in Canada, it's definitely available on iTunes and Amazon.
Okay. So we don't want to spoil too much. You definitely still have to watch it. If you're in the UK or Australia, you'll have to find a way to listen to this.
Request it from Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Hit them up. I'm sure they take kindly to that. So thanks so much for coming over. It was really great talking to you, Deva.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. Recapping reality since 2015. Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show is engineered by Will Scoville. For as little as $1 a month, you can donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help us in other ways, please share the show. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on the site. SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, got a film or opinions, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.